Let's have an AA meeting.
Let's have one.
My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Happy holidays. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year of sobriety or more tells his or her story.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately indeed, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Mike was here 2 weeks ago supporting a speaker named Preston that had come down to the Johns Creek group. He participated in our meeting. Just the spirit that he approached it and the support that he was giving Preston, I wanted to fill a slot as fast as possible. He didn't resist. He said, well, y'all don't want me. And I said, oh, yes, we do. And here he is. So this is Mike. Welcome.
My name's Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. It's an honor to be up here and just share my experience, strength, and hope. My sobriety date is July 22nd, 2011. It's real easy for me to remember because my birth date is July 23rd, 1961. So 49 years, 364 days it took for me to finally succumb to my problem with alcohol. I was 50 years old, so it's real easy. All I have to do is remember my birth date now, subtract 50, and I know how many years sober I got. But this program, it was a real gift for me. My story is more on denial, delusion, and everything else. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. I was born in Roanoke, Virginia in 1961. I have two other brothers. Our childhood was just like, you know, any normal childhood. Basically, like Leave It to Beaver, we're mischievous little kids, and you know, the parents sent you outside, you didn't come back till dinner, and you know, everything was harmless. The earliest memory I have of living in Virginia at that time, I think I was going into first grade because I was the oldest of the brothers, and I didn't ask a lot of questions, but I remember at the end of the day, after my first day of school, I was the only one on the bus riding home that day. Because I was the last one left at school because I didn't ask anybody how to get home. And so when I got to my house, you can only see the forehead outside the school bus window. My mother standing out there in shock. And I come off the bus like I had just been driven up in a limousine. So I had a lot of pride in the fact that I did it on my own. Now, as time went on, I always thought that alcohol was something to make things fun. Make things better and make people happy. My parents, my father was an only child. My mother and that side of the family had five uncles and two aunts, and alcoholism runs extreme on that side. But when I was young, I didn't know that. I thought that when we went to family reunions, the gentlemen always lined up at the trunk of the car. The ladies were always at the picnic table having food. The guys were laughing and having a good time, and we'd like to go over there to see what they're doing. But never saw anything wrong with that. Again, it was just, you know, observations at a young age. And, you know, later in life when I look back at it, I realized that, you know, I wanted to be a part of that too. Moved here to Atlanta in 1969. I was in third grade. And, again, everything was basic. Through school, built a big network of friends, and everything was great. Now, here in Atlanta, back in that time, there was no middle grade. It was first to seventh, then high school. between seventh grade and eighth grade, I had a lot of anxiety about going into eighth grade because of all the stories, all everything you heard about being a sub-freshman. You were going to be attacked. You're going to be humiliated. Everything else becomes you're a sub-freshman and you're in high school. Well, you know, again, because I've been down here since 1969 and we're getting, you know, from third grade through seventh, built a big network of friends and all that, I felt pretty good. But that summer, all my friends, and I had a network of friends that was huge. I didn't see them anymore. I was wondering what was going on. And I had this one friend, his name was Brad. And he came up to me that summer and he goes, "Hey, Mike, what are you doing?" I said, "Nothing, man. I'm wondering where everybody is." He goes, "Well, why don't you come outside and smoke a joint with me?" I'm like, "Why?" He said, "Well, just try it." So I went out there and I did it. And then he opened up to me and says, "Everybody's doing this. Why do you think no one's hanging out with you?" And I sat there, and that was my gateway to get back my friends. So I started smoking, you know, I started smoking some pot. Went into eighth grade, and that was the lingo, because back then, you know, walking through the streets and we're going to school, you see all your friends that you used to see, but they had a glow about their eyes. They were red. So then, you know, you knew that that guy was connected. You look at their fingers. Back then, it was strawberry papers. Now, this is just a part of my story, because where it leads to from here is that was just the start, because I knew that by associating myself with drugs, I had my friends back. When I associated myself with alcohol, things became great, because then I didn't just have friends, I had new friends. And everything we did was fun. So in eighth grade, that's when I got connected with my first experience with alcohol. We used to go camping in the woods a lot. Just me and my friends. Mom, Dad would take my sleeping bag and have a campfire at night. Then we'd go stand out in front of the 7-Eleven and get somebody to buy some beer. And that was fun. It was cute. No harm in it as far as what we saw at the time. But my first experience as far as what, you know, having any consequences was we got hard liquor. And it was Canadian Mist. And I drank the hell out of it. And I got sicker than a dog. So my rationalization was, I'll never drink Canadian Mist again. And that's what happened. I thought I solved all my problems, because I really did have fun when I drank. My friends had fun when we drank, and we had fun when we drank. Now I'm still in eighth grade. We're camping in the woods again. This time we're behind the high school. And we have M80s. Now, M80s today aren't M80s of what they had back then. Those were some real M80s. We fired them off at night, sets off the silent alarm at that high school, and we're in the woods, and the police come, helicopters come, we get pulled out, the vice principal comes out, and we're sitting over there, and I don't know how drunk we really were, but, you know, young kids trying to impress each other, acting really stupid. We probably were drunk. I know we were drunk, but how drunk, I don't know. But I wasn't drunk very long when the vice principal came up and took my name down, took their names down, and then he gave us a chance to sit there, and he goes, "It's Friday night. I'll deal with you gentlemen Monday morning." So that gives you the weekend to tell your parents about your experience with alcohol. I thought that was wonderful, because that gave me 2 days not to worry about it. And I didn't. I just figured the less I worried about it, the less I thought about it, this situation would go away. Well, I get called into the vice principal's office on that Monday, and he didn't have any good news for me, because what I was afraid to do for myself, he freely did for me. He called my mother. So when I got home that day, she's crying. "Oh my God, you're an alcoholic. You're in eighth grade." And, you know, I'm sitting there and I see absolutely nothing wrong with what I'm doing. I'm just a young kid, got caught having a little bit of fun. So that was the first time I had any repercussions from that. Then we started having parties, spent a lot of time camping out in the woods, and, you know, didn't have any further consequences with that, you know, in the near future. 1977, I found out that we had to move to Rhode Island, up in New England. that broke my heart, because I had set roots down here as far as all my friends and all that, and life was great, and I loved what I was doing, and now I'm moving to the smallest state in the world. The state's so small, you can set it inside of 285. I did not want to go. I'm going into 11th grade. Oh, my God, my life is over. So I get up there, and it's worse than I thought. I had blonde hair and a southern accent, and everyone up there is Italian, and they've never left the state of Rhode Island. So how do I make friends? You look for commonalities. And next thing you know is I found some people that drank, that smoked, and they connected me with all their friends, and suddenly I'm back in business again, and life is good. I experienced a few things while we were up there. No real major problems at this point, because the way that my story goes is, I was born in the 60s and 70s was experimentation. When the 80s came, it was great. Everything was a first. When the 90s came, that's when I started getting nicked up, but I could still justify, I could rationalize. There's a lot of things I could still do. And then the millennium came, and the wheels were coming off the cart. And that's the part I'll get to, because that's what brought me to my knees, because I was in such denial. I went to Rhode Island and stayed up there for 3 years. My mother couldn't stand it. She wanted to come back here. She's an old Southern lady who old school, Southern Belle. So she couldn't stand the cold, had everything done for her, and wanted to come south. My dad obliged her. But me, I had found a girl and decided I was going to stay up there because I'm 18. I'm old enough to do what I want. I can drink. It's legal. I have a job, and I don't want to go nowhere. So I stayed. 6 months later, they're asking me to come down and, he's got a job opportunity where he started a company, wanted me to come in. If it doesn't work out, hell, Mike, at least you get a little experience. You can land a job with another company. I was doing absolutely nothing. It was like, okay, no problem. But you can't have her come down here to live with you. No problem, we'll get married. I'd known her. She was 15 years old. I was 16 years old when we first met. I taught her how to drive a car. She turned 18 in December. We were married in January, and we took a one-week honeymoon heading south to Atlanta. The funniest part about that is if you saw pictures of what it looked like when I was 19 years old, walking into a Holiday Inn to give them cash or a room, it was hysterical. But, hysterical, but a fine memory. But we got down to Atlanta. I went to work for my father. He just wanted me to get enough experience because he saw the direction I was taking. I'm just partying, having a good time. Not once in my life up to that point had I ever looked past the immediate. I'd never planned for the future. I'd never planned down the road. I was just happy with where I was at, looking forward to the weekend or whatever. The company starts to take off. Not only is it going to go past 6 months, this thing's turning into the point where my father wants to jump back in and be full-time with me. I had arrived, because now I was connected with the people he knew, and he's much older, and these guys, I came into the business right at the turn of old school business versus new school business. The old school business, you had an elderly man who was in the purchasing department, and everything was done by hand as far as counting the inventory. A handshake was your word, and the better the price was based on volume. If you had a lot of volume, you got a better price. Well, that part was changing, and once you get to know these people, go out to drink with them, you build the connection because it's products that are disposable and all, and I was told I would never make it in the business. So I had something to prove to people. Still didn't think long term, but I had something to prove. So next thing you know is I had broken the barrier. Now I'm drinking with the big guys at their table. I'm having a good time with it, and I'm getting knowledge from them, and then I'm learning. Now the business cycle has changed. Computers are coming in. Now inventory is done, and it's not about volume and price and a handshake. You've got contracts. Everything is about consolidation. It's about cash flow. It's about turnover. And now you got people who don't do business the way it used to be done. I mean, in the 80s, lunch was a power lunch. You went out, you had drinks at lunch, you had drinks at night. You took the customers out for drinks. If you did great, you were rewarded with bottles. when you're out there on the nights, you're going, you got expense accounts, you know, in the 80s, Bennigan's was wonderful. 3-for-1 happy hour. That was great, and that's what I lived for. That was just Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. You wake up in the morning, I found out that alcohol could be like medicine. Bloody Marys took care of hangovers. I still had everything covered. But and I really planned on living my life out that way, because I was stupid. I was making stupid money, and it was fun, and I was happy. Hadn't planned on the future, because the future was now. I had arrived. It's going to be this way forever. 1988, I got my first DUI. I keep thinking of this thing I saw one time, because it was my first DUI, because I didn't believe it. I was in denial about it and justification, and it wasn't because I was drinking or anything like that. And it brings me back to this thing I saw not too long ago. Cop says, "You been drinking?" And I said, "You buying?" He laughed, I laughed, need bail money. So, and that's about what happened. Because I was in Florida, and McDonald's right next to work to where I was at, instead of walking over there, I drove over there. I drove back. I got pulled over, and we're in an area where it's the only place in town to drink. They know it's all about salesmen. They sit there, they watch, blah, blah, blah. Next thing you know is I get pulled over. They don't know who they're dealing with. Sure they do. They hauled me in. And when I got out of there, I was going to find out. I was going to get a lawyer. I was going to do this. And I talked to them. They said, "Son, let me just tell you something. You're from Atlanta. And down here, those jurors of your peer know the police. They live with the police. They grew up with the police. And if you want to fight it, that's fine. But if you lose, you're going to go to jail right then and there. Is that the direction you want to go? How much is it going to cost?" So they told me. I paid it, walked away from it as a bad experience, but I didn't have a problem. I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that system was crooked, and there's no way I was going to win, so I just keep on going. 1993, got another DUI. The problem is, I learned just enough from the first one not to get caught drinking and driving. I'm ashamed of it now. I wasn't ashamed of it then, because I was in a delusion that I didn't have a problem, but I like to drink. So 1993, I get another DUI, but it's outside the 1 in 5 rule, so it's just like the first time offense. No problem. I've got money. I can pay for it. I can justify it. Don't worry about it, Mike. This guy's got 3 DUIs, so I'm not that bad. Now, as time starts to roll on from this point, I'm getting in a little bit more trouble, a little bit more trouble, and the people that I'm hanging around with, I started hanging around with, the people that I respected, I'm not hanging around with them no more, because I don't want them to see what's happening to me, don't want to tell them what's happening to me, and I don't want to get caught and have somebody confront me about drinking, because that's something between me and myself, and nobody else. Now, I created this image as far as I was being treated, you know, the way I responded, the way people perceived me, and the way I acted in public. But it wasn't working anymore just from the excitement of fulfilling things by doing good things. I needed alcohol to make some of this stuff happen anymore, because I wasn't that happy. I wasn't feeling that good. But alcohol took that away. And if I had a few drinks, I was feeling good. And if I had to go to a party, I couldn't sit there, you know, my wife starting to nag at me about having some drinks. "Well, Mike, you're drinking a little too much." Going to parties, "Hey, Mike, when are you drinking?" And I'm the life of the party all of a sudden. If I'm not the life of the party, nobody's going to have fun. So if I go to the party, the only way I can have fun is make sure everybody drinks as much as I do. That way they don't see how much I'm drinking, because they're going to be too drunk to know. It worked for a little while. But people know how to say no. Or it's just know when to stop, and I couldn't do it. So the next phase was isolation. I started drinking, you know, by myself. I got another DUI. When I got this DUI right here, it was the first time I got exposed to AA. I wish it was the first time that I got a white chip, and the only time I got a white chip. If I only knew then what I know now. I've heard that one said before, but it takes what it takes. And even then, I wasn't ready. I went into my first AA meeting, had no idea what to expect. And I'm sitting there, and I'm here, and I'm looking in the room just like this. A lot of people that look good, look happy. And when they would talk, the things they were saying profound. I'm wondering where they got it. I didn't know because I wasn't listening. You know, they were coming right out of the big book. You know, I heard things about get a sponsor, go to meetings, go through the book, go through the steps. I didn't hear any of that. I just knew if I was going to AA meetings, this is going to look good when I go in front of the judge. Went in front of the judge, paid my fine, still 1 in 5. So I'm not doing too bad. Years pass, and, you know, I'm getting worse. I'm isolating now. I'm not happy no matter what I do. Waking up in the... I'm not waking up. Let's say I'm coming to. 4 in the morning. I'm not going to drink today. I'm going to drink today. I'm not going to drink today. Oh, my God. What time does the liquor store open up? It's 8 o'clock. Oh, my God. It's 6 o'clock right now. 2 hours. What am I going to do? This proceeded to go on for a long time, yet I still wasn't ready to give in. Wasn't ready to get in. I got my last DUI. This was going to be the one. I mean, it was bad. Nobody hurt other than me, my material things. But I really felt at that time this was going to be the one. And so I went into a rehab center. And I went in there gung-ho, ready to do it, ready to give up. But I'm an alcoholic. And if I could sit there and find a trap door that'll make it so I can go back out again, I'm going to do it. And the reason I'm going to do it, because I haven't admitted to my innermost self that I was done. And I didn't. But I went in there at that time honestly believing this was the last time. I was there for 2 weeks. This is it. I'm good to go. And they said, Mike, we're going to go ahead and let you out. I didn't want out. Because now it's starting to take over. The longer I'm in here, the better it's going to look for the court. So I was able to stay for 30 days. I get out. I'm going to meetings. I got 9 months. And sold my company. And I knew at that point in time that once I sold my company, that I had basically given up my freedom as far as what I could do, what I couldn't do, income-wise and a few other things. But I was prepared to do this for the rest of my life. I was going to be status quo. That was the worst thing I ever did in my life because I decided I was just going to lay down. And I was going to drink, and I was not motivated. I was just going to do this for the rest of my life as is. Started going down the tubes. At the end of 2010... we're coming into 2011. It's funny because, you know, Facebook's a big thing. I got pictures, you know, my kids, they show pictures of us in the 80s, and I got pictures of me now. I got some pictures of me in the 90s. I don't like looking at the ones in the 2000s. Because when I look at those, man, I see exactly what I look like. I was red in the face. I was puffy. I looked horrible. But you know, when I get up in the morning and I look in the mirror back in those days and I see that, oh my man, it ain't that bad. So then I take a couple plugs and I look in that mirror and go, well, you know, it's looking better. I'll be okay. One of the movies I saw and I could really relate to was Leaving Las Vegas, when Nicolas Cage is in there at the bank and he's standing in line and he's shaking and he's nutting up and he's got that check and he gets up to that teller, he can't talk, he can't write, can't do nothing, he goes, I'll be back. I had that moment. I had to stand in front of a whole crowd of people. I had to give a thing in front of our entire company, and all I wanted to do was run, and I couldn't. No place to hide, nowhere to go. I don't know how I made it through it, but I went around the corner when I came out and I threw up. And then I went to the room and grabbed the bottle. And I drank. And I felt better. And then I proceeded to kick myself in the ass the entire time about why I had hit the point where I couldn't even stand in front of people and talk. I couldn't do this. I couldn't do that. And I had this. I had that. And I just beat myself to death. Beat myself to death. Beat myself to death. So at the end of 2010, I sold my company and went to work for this company. I've been with them for 8 years. And I lost my job. At that time, I hated them. I hated them. They don't know who I think I am. They have no idea. looking back on it now that I've been in recovery, they didn't want to fire me. All they wanted to do was help me get better because I was an asset. But I didn't see that. They went, I wouldn't have tolerated from anybody what they tolerated from me. But I didn't see it at that time. So anyway, I'm out of a job and I'm laying in bed at night and I'm already 1 year down the road. I don't have a house. I don't have a job. And, you know, I haven't even been unemployed 24 hours, but my life is over and I'm 1 year down the road living on the street, living on the streets. Hadn't even thought about giving up alcohol because the next morning I woke up in a bed of sweat. I was at the liquor store, got me another bottle. I'll deal with it later. This went on for months. I hit my bottom July 22nd, 2011. I'll never forget it. My wife had threatened to leave me three times over the years. Got my lawyer three times. I'm sitting in my basement. Divorce papers in hand. It's over. I'm tired of it. We've had it and die. I wanted to tune her out. I've done it so many other times, you know. She had taken the keys from me in the past. I still could get to the liquor store. Taking my money, I still found money. No matter what, if I wanted alcohol, I was going to get it. And so she had said something about, what are you going to do? Just like that. And you know, something just happened in my head. I thought about the last 15 years. You know, going all the way back to 1996, after the second DUI, and what had happened since then, how my job, my career, the family, everything's going down the tubes and all that. And everything was all about alcohol. And I tried everything to stop. On my own. And I'm going, you know, why not? And when I did that, something happened. It was, the weight of the world was lifted off of me at that moment. Haven't had a drink since, and I was willing to do whatever it took. See, the one thing I had learned since I've come into AA from 98 up till the date that I had surrendered, was that any time I was in the AA program, regardless if I had a sponsor, regardless if I'd gone through the steps, regardless if I'd gone through the book, regardless if I shared in a meeting, I didn't drink. That was the common, that was the common denominator throughout. But this time it was different. The only problem was I was the only one who knew it. Because I admitted to my innermost self, this was over. Because I don't know why I couldn't get it sooner. Other than the fact I didn't want to get it. And it takes what it takes to get it. And for me, that's exactly what it took. I'm sitting there in the basement of my house. I got divorce papers sitting on my shoulder. My family is completely decimated by everything that I've done. The word I'm sorry doesn't work anymore. Nobody wants to hear that. Actions speak louder than words. I went to a halfway house on the worst side of Atlanta. I used to fly first class. I used to eat at all the best places. Now I'm riding more. I'm in the worst part of Atlanta. And you know what? I was happy as hell. I was happy as hell because I didn't look at this as what I was going to do the next week. It was just for that day. I wanted to work this program perfect. I'd never done it before. When I came into this program, those times when I was just toying with it, so to speak, I came in on the third step. There's a reason the steps are in order. I never got over step number one. But the thing was, I came in this time, I got a sponsor, and I was pushing him to get me through them because I heard, got to do the steps. 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to 180 meetings in 90 days. I was pushing it. And I didn't have a job, so all I had to do was work on me. And it was great. What had happened was, while I'm out there, now my legal record wasn't really good for getting a job for another company. It was a damn good resume to be a substance abuse counselor. So I went and I got my associate's degree for substance abuse counseling in that time because I wanted to help other people just like me. And the things that have happened in this program because of this program was always here for me. See, my ego was so big. Anytime I ever went back out, I was afraid to come back. I didn't want people to think something of me. Who does he think he is? And everyone's here. This program's been here with or without me, but it's always been here. I just needed to want it for myself. And when I wanted it for myself, the program became real simple. Real simple. Don't drink. Go to meetings. Get a sponsor. I got a network of friends. I have a bunch of them that showed up tonight for support. And that's heartfelt. Now, moving forward, you know, I just, when I came in this time, I really just wanted to stop drinking. That's it. I just wanted to stop drinking. I didn't know what was going to happen after that, but it's been nothing but a gift. I got a granddaughter now. She's named after me. That's a gift. My name's Michael. Her name's Michaela. And I got another one on the way. And again, everyone wants to be around me, and no one wants to be not around me. And for that, I am very grateful, because this program, if you really want it, it'll work. Because I didn't mention that, and I bounced around a little bit as far as the story. I've been to rehab. I went to rehab 3 times. The first time I went to rehab, all I wanted to do was go down there to check it out. I went down with my mother. My wife stayed at home. We walked in Peachford Center, and they started asking me a few questions. I couldn't tell them anything. My mother sitting right there. How much do you drink? Oh, not that much. And so I lied to them from the start. How can you get sober when you can't, you know, any bit of wiggle room for me? That's all I need, was wiggle room. You know, because if I have wiggle room, the trap door's open, because it just being out to drink later. I went to a company function, and I didn't want them to know that I had a problem with drinking, because to me, in my mind, if I admitted I had a problem with drinking, I was weak. I was weak. And I wasn't weak. I was, you know, and I hung onto that thought until it damn near killed me. So went to my first function after the first time of not drinking. Not being sober, just not drinking. So I was standing there with a drink that was supposed to look like a cocktail but wasn't. And I didn't know the difference in, you know, cups, glasses, or anything like that. I thought, you know, all cups were the same. So I'm sitting there with a Coke cup, and someone comes up, "Mike, why are you drinking a Coke?" I thought it was supposed to be a fake bourbon or something like that. And then instead of doing what I should have done at that time, now I don't have a problem with it, was I'm not drinking. And I just said, "Oh man, I thought it was something else," because I wanted that wiggle room, because there might be a chance that I'd be drinking down the road, and then I had to explain to them why I wasn't drinking back then, which means I'd have to tell them I had a problem. And if I admitted I had a problem, then I'd have to do something about it. And I didn't ever want to go there. I didn't want to go there. But anyway, as far as this program itself, it is a gift that keeps on giving, and I am so grateful for it. I could take my story, you know, several different directions and all that, but I'm going to keep it simple. This program saved my life. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Great story. We've asked for someone to come up and hand out the chips tonight. Jim W.?
Yes, me.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm Jim W. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Mike, thank you. I'm grateful to have you as a friend. All right, we have a chip system here. Time markers on our journey into sobriety. First one is the white chip. If you were like me, just sick and tired of being sick and tired, we have a white chip. You want to give this thing a try, anybody? All right.
As I rode from town to town, can't put the bar. bottle down. Right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing. Need something to take the edge, you see. I got nowhere to hide. An empty hole inside. It's the bottle of a book or the gun for me. Seems like everyone's out to get me. Trouble always follows.